Welcome to Two-Way Street. Richard Russo first wrote about life in the small towns of upstate New York and the dashed hopes of the people who live in them in his novel Mohawk. When it was published in 1986, the New York Times called Russo, quote, a talented newcomer. In the novels that followed, when he wasn't writing about the characters in small towns, he gave us books that spoofed the insular culture of academia. The book that really put him on the map was Nobody's Fool. It featured a prototypical Russo protagonist, Daniel Sullivan, Sully. He was a broken 60-year-old, drinking far too much, unemployable, estranged from his grown son, divorced from his wife, forever scarred by a childhood dominated by a violent father. And yet, like so many Russo heroes, Sully is given an unexpected opportunity to connect with the better angels of his nature. And that's the thing about Richard Russo. His heart seems to be far too big to deny his characters the chance to turn their lives around. Paul Newman played Sully in the movie version of Nobody's Fool, and in the making of that picture, Russo and Newman became close friends, working together on two more pictures based on Russo's books. Now in his new book, Trajectory, Stories, a collection of four stories, Russo revisits the themes that made him so popular and critically successful. The final story in the book, as you'll hear later in our conversation, is a love letter to his friend Paul Newman and a cautionary tale about the corrupting influence of Hollywood. Richard Russo, thanks for being here for Two-Way Street.
Thank you.
As I was reading your new book, Trajectory, I came across a quote that I thought would be a good way to start our conversation. In one of your stories, which is about a young college professor, Janet Moore, and we'll talk about her more in a little while. But she's meeting with her esteemed professor, one of the great literature critics, Marcus Bellamy in American Letters. And he tells her this. It's the greatest of mysteries, I think, what it's like to be another person, to be William. What it feels like, I mean, literature, life. They give us little glimpses, leaving us hungry for more. And it occurs to me that's what your whole life as a writer is about.
I think so. Yeah. When I sit down every day to work on a story or a novel or whatever, you'd be crazy to think about anything really large because it's beyond our ken to imagine something huge. But these little glimpses that we get, if you can get one or two of those on any given day, you've had a good day. these little glimpses that lift us outside of ourselves, because I think self-consciousness is the great enemy of art. The more consumed we are with our own lives, our own skins, our own existence off the page, the less alive our work will be. And so we first have to get in some basic way get over ourselves. We have to forget who we are allow the possibility of what is the ultimate magic, I think, and that is to imagine being William, being Janet, being somebody else. And it's not a matter of intellectual understanding. It's a question of what does it feel like?
What's fascinating about that is you're not just talking about what your work as a writer is. You're really saying something about all of us as empathetic beings.
Right. Yeah. You're talking about moral imagination, which is an absolutely essential, I think, attribute of any kind of artist, certainly writers, but any kind of artist, moral imagination, the ability to imagine what it feels like to be somebody else is absolutely essential. But in another more general way, it's really important for all of us as human beings to be able to imagine what it's like to be in somebody else's skin. It's important in the artistic realm, but it's also important in politics. It's important in religion. It's important in throughout the culture. And when what you often notice, of course, in any of these realms is its absence.
I would suggest that that's an issue that we're struggling with right now as a people, as an American people, is trying to imagine what the other is really dealing with and feeling.
No argument from me there.
You know, it's interesting. All right. I mentioned William in my little reading of the quote about Marcus Bellamy. You did too. Just so our listeners don't get lost, we're going to come back to William because he's a remarkable minor character in one of your stories. But here's what else is interesting about the Marcus Bellamy quote. After he says the things that we just discussed about what it's like trying to figure out what it's like to be another person, he says something else. He says, "I like to know who people are, but sometimes I forget it's none of my business." And I wonder, as a writer, if you ever think, I'm assuming that characters that you've written over your remarkable career, you've drawn from real life.
Sure.
You could not have done otherwise because your characters are so real. Do you sometimes think it's none of your business and that you've intruded on the people who you've chosen to put into your books and stories?
Often. Probably never more than when I wrote my memoir, which came out a few years ago. And there, I think, even more than in my fiction, which you're right. I mean, all of you. Imagination, we always talk about leaps of imagination. Well, you don't leap from the air into the air. You leap from something solid on the ground. And that is, you know, our experiences of life. And sometimes that means our parents or our siblings or our lovers or, you know, any real experiences in the real world. And I'm incapable of telling literal truth about anything for very long. So I'm usually imagination is what gets me out of that feeling of guilt when I find myself talking about someone who is real, who is alive, who might read what I've written and recognize herself or himself. And so you worry about that until you begin to tell, until you begin to expand and to tell lies about, and once the character becomes yours, then you don't have to worry about that quite so much anymore. But in memoir, when you're talking about a real person, in this case, my mother, and when you're talking about a real place, in this case, Gloversville, New York, where my mother and I both grew up, spent our formative years, it's a different equation. And my mother, whose life, I mean, my memoir is really more about my mother's life than mine. And in talking about her, even after her death, I did have that feeling of intrusion, of violation. Most important for me to tell were, in essence, her secrets to keep, and she kept them throughout most of her life. None of my business. None of my business in a very, very simple way, except in another equally valid way, it was my business.
Will we find pieces of who your mother was in your novels? Nobody's Fool, Everybody's Fool.
Sure. Yeah.
What are examples of that, little pieces of her that you've placed throughout your books?
Probably the first instance was my second novel, The Risk Pool, which is, in a way, a what-if scenario. And we use these sometimes. So those of us who teach fiction writing will sometimes use prompts like this with students. Write about something that might have happened but didn't. Right. And The Risk Pool is one big write about something that might have happened but didn't. And in this case, it was, what if my mother had had some sort of maybe nervous breakdown or some sort of health issue that would have required me not to live with her, but rather with my father, who was absent for much of my childhood and adolescence. And so Sam Hall in that book is another version of my absent father brought onto the stage by virtue of my fictional mother's in that book having something happen to her that never happened to her in real life. My mother was always nervous, terribly anxious, worried about one day having a nervous breakdown, and so in that book I gave her one. And Jenny, who struggles so hard to get her life back and to get her son back and get her son away from his feckless and ne'er-do-well but also extremely charismatic father, is maybe the first example, one of the first examples in my fiction of a you know, a slightly skewed, turned around, turned upside down. And I don't know whether my mother ever recognized herself in that portrait or not. If she did, she didn't say so.
One of the things that's great about this book is it allows us to really kind of cover the major themes in your mm-hmm. writing over the years, because it's kind of a petri dish for topics that you have always been attracted to and that you're now so well known for writing about. So, if I may, mm-hmm. let's walk through some of
you
them,
may.
Okay? One of them is the disappointment of life, especially as people approach or move past middle life. Yes?
Absolutely. And never more so than in this book. It is probably the most common thematic thread in this book, is that sense that we have of on the one hand, we feel like we have a destiny that we're living out, and on the other hand, at some point, many of us look at the lives that we have led, and find them somehow not to be the lives we imagined that we were going to lead in our 20s and 30s, and all of the characters in this book have kind of had this awakening, where they're suddenly looking at themselves clearly for the first time, discovering that they're not promising young people anymore with their whole lives ahead of them, that in fact that they're somewhere past the midway mark. And if things aren't etched in stone, they are pretty close. It's going to take, at this point, if their lives are going to end up different, they're going to have to turn this ship around in the harbor. Right? Which, as we all know, is much more difficult than turning it around when you're still out to sea.
Well, a great example of that is the character of Nate in your story, Voice. Mm-hmm. He's been a teacher, mm-hmm. He's been dismissed from his job in a, we'll learn about why when you read the story, but it hasn't been a pleasant parting of the ways. He's in his mid-60s, probably.
Mid to late, yep.
He's come to Venice.
Yep.
And he's confronted there with, more than ever, the recognition that life has not given him what he had hoped for and expected. And he has to deal with his brother, Julian. Mm-hmm. That's another theme that's really interesting. You deal with lots of brothers and the way in which brothers relate. But Nate is one of those people who he's not even sure he's – am I going too far to say he sometimes thinks of himself as not being present?
Yes. Yes. Not present in his own life because he has lived the wrong one. There's an interesting subplot to this in which he remembers summers working with a builder. And
the Hanscom building company.
Yes, Mr. Hanscom, who has encouraged him to stay on instead of going back to school. Nate has been pursuing this life of the mind. Is worried about the fact that now after a long, long teaching career, he's never been a mentor to a really brilliant student. Has begun to come to terms with the fact that he has not been an inspiring teacher. Nevertheless, it's these summers that he remembers working for Mr. Hanscom, and at the beginning of the summer, he'd kind of be, you know, kind of soft from all those months at the university library and in his library carrel. But by the end of the summer, his body would be hard and taut, and he loved the discipline of building things because of its honesty. He loved the fact that you could build a wall. You could tell it was a good wall because it didn't fall down, you know. And if you fixed a car, you know, the car wasn't running, and by the time you finished working on it, it did run. So you did a good job. And he liked the honesty of that. And Nate has just, over the years, had this suspicion that what he loved about that hard physical labor was an honesty that just wasn't all that prevalent in the life that he has in fact chosen and led.
So I think now we have to take a little journey, a side track.
Yep.
Had Nate pursued that life, the life of working in construction, he might very well have been the protagonist in a different Richard Russo story, mm-hmm. because so many of the characters that you have written about from mm-hmm. Nobody's Fool are, in fact, working people,
mm-hmm.
Blue-collar workers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So let's plunge into it and get it behind us.
Okay.
I think you've told other interviewers that you're quite aware, having watched the 2016 presidential race,
that
your characters were probably Trump voters.
Yeah.
And I think you've said you're not particularly happy about that.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, you know, and I was asked the very next day, because I had agreed in a moment of weakness, I had agreed to do an interview talking about the election when it looked like the election was going to be have a different outcome than it had. And I had agreed to go on the radio and talk about it. And so that was, of course, the question that I got. You know, it's strange, too, because this is the first time I can ever remember, because I've always been viewed as an entertainer, and this is the first time I've ever been asked for political wisdom. But boy, was I asked that first time, and I was asked how would your characters have voted. I spun the question a little bit differently, really to my own detriment, in the sense that because I was writing about blue-collar, working-class people all of my life. I've been working about, writing about these people who work really hard, don't make an awful lot of money, don't have an awful lot of advantages, don't have an awful lot of arrows to their quiver sometimes. And so I've been writing about these people, from Sully to Miles Roby in Empire Falls to Lucy Lynch in Bridge of Sighs. And a lot of these people that I've been writing about in the sociological sense, we know were divided for a long time between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. But after Hillary Clinton won the nomination, then a lot of these blue collar workers, white blue collar workers, with no Bernie Sanders to go to, many of them did become Trump voters. And so I said, yeah, that's what happened. But the question that I was asked, interestingly, was who would my characters have voted for? And that's the question I should have asked. That's the question I should have answered. Because take Miss Burrell, for instance, who is so important to both Nobody's Fool and Everybody's mm-hmm. Fool. She would have figured Donald Trump out in about 2 seconds flat for the grifter that he was. And that's what I should have said. He certainly wouldn't have fooled Miss Burrell. And what about Sully?
Who's probably, fair to say, your most famous character.
Sure. Paul Newman didn't play any of my other characters. he did play Max Roby. But Sully. What about Sully? Well, Sully is a guy that, like my own father, was a D-Day guy who was part of the Normandy invasion, made it through the hedgerows of France and into Germany and the Hürtgen Forest, and made it all the way to Berlin. A man, Sully, like my father, knows a little bit about service to country. And I doubt seriously, even though some of Trump's themes would have been interesting to my father, I think my father would certainly agree that working class people doing the kinds of jobs that he had done throughout his life were and are undervalued in America. Nevertheless, it's hard to imagine my father having done what he did in the service of his country would have been wild about electing as commander-in-chief and as president of our nation someone who had never offered any service to his country, either militarily or other. So it's hard to imagine my father or Sully voting. It's not hard to imagine Karl Roebuck from Nobody's Fool voting for
Why?
Donald Trump.
Why not?
Because he's a grifter too.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, more with novelist Richard Russo. If you're just joining us, my guest on Two-Way Street is the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Richard Russo. His new book, Trajectory, recounts the themes that have made him such a well-loved and critically successful writer. Stories about the broken dreams and unexpected opportunities for redemption of people living in the small towns in the Northeast. It strikes me that you understood the blue-collar American dilemma, because you wrote about it throughout, you've written about it throughout your literary career. So whether your specific characters may or may not have voted for Trump, you may have understood better than the Democratic Party what those people contend with and continue to contend with, and because you've written about them.
And I've written about them because I had what I thought as a younger writer might be a liability, because I came from what I thought of as a 20-year-old as an uninteresting place. You know, I wanted to, as a younger writer, I wanted to write about cities. I wanted to write about crime. I wanted to write about dames. I wanted to write about, you know, I wanted to be Raymond Chandler. And I thought, what am I going to write about that will be nearly as interesting as those things coming from where I've come from? But in fact, Gloversville, New York, where I grew up, and which was my fictional Mohawk, my fictional Thomaston, my fictional Empire Falls, my fictional North Bath, all of those are based in some extent on Gloversville. And Gloversville in the late 1950s and early 60s was the petri dish that the entire nation has become in its aftermath. It was in Gloversville that I saw all of those blue-collar jobs, my grandfather's work, much of my family's work. Many of the women sewed gloves. We saw glove cutting. We saw the tanneries. We saw all of those. We saw all of those jobs go overseas because the owners of the tanneries simply would not dispose of their lethal toxins the way they were supposed to. They simply went off overseas to poison other communities. I saw that happening. I saw all of those jobs go away. I saw what happened to communities that not only didn't have any jobs anymore, they didn't have any work anymore. They didn't know where they fit into the society, to the fabric of American society, given the fact that they no longer gave something. They didn't give those gloves and the value of their work to the nation anymore. So who were they?
You know, under other circumstances, you could have been a journalist writing journalistically about the lives of those people. That's fascinating to me.
Yeah.
So let me take you back to the themes that you've mm-hmm. written about so much. It's not surprising that you studied philosophy, because your characters are in the grip of such existential crises, part mm-hmm. of the ones that we've just mentioned, which is, who am I at this stage in my life? It didn't turn out the way I wanted it to. I think part of that is you have a character, a woman named Nikki, mm-hmm. who's really down on her luck in mm-hmm. one of your stories. And she's talking to your protagonist in that story, Ray,
right.
who's a real estate right. agent in the middle of the recession, mm-hmm. struggling to make a living. And she says something really poignant to him. She says, "Will you hate me if I tell you something? I always thought I was special." That's a heartbreaking statement.
Right.
But it's also what any number of your characters in this story are contending with. They suddenly realize...
And in all the stories, yeah.
They're not special.
They're not special. They're not special. And our sense in many of these characters, their sense of being special doesn't come out of the ether. They didn't just wake up one morning and look at themselves in the mirror and think to themselves, "Oh, I'm pretty," or "Oh, I'm smart," or "Oh, I'm any of these things." Generally, this notion that we are special comes to us from someone who loves us.
Yeah, Nikki says, "My father always told me I was special," and I believed him.
Yes, yes, and what he probably meant to say was that he loved her; she was special to him. But what she's heard is something completely different. You know, that she is special by virtue of being, prettier or smarter or whatever conclusions that she has drawn about herself have burrowed so deep in her that in her 50s, it's almost impossible for her to think of herself in any other way.
Is it wrong for us to want to think that we're special?
Sure. I think to the extent that means that other people have to be treated differently because they are not as special as we are. I think we have every right to think of ourselves as special in the sense that no one has ever lived precisely this life before. That's what makes it valuable to us.
But not special as privilege.
But not special as privilege.
Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's how not being special has affected the other character in that story, Ray.
Yeah.
Ray's sick.
Yes. Yes.
And Ray's not certain that he wants to do anything about the cancer that apparently is growing inside of him.
Right. Right.
Because he doesn't know that he's worthy of being cured.
Right. Right. It's a strange almost self-loathing, isn't it, that would cause a man his age, especially who's married to a woman that he loves and who loves him. But again, it goes right back to his parents, and in particular, his father, because not only is Ray sick, he's also been given the opportunity to jump the line, because he has a friend who can he says make a phone call to an eminent surgeon in Boston. He wouldn't even have to have this operation that he needs in Maine. He could go right to Mass General in Boston. But his unwillingness to deal with his cancer has something to do with the fact that in order to do that, he would have to jump the line. He would have to say, "My life is more important than the lives of other people who have been standing here for a while." And for Ray and also his brother Bill, this has been a central...
Another theme of brothers.
This has been a central dilemma of their lives because their father has never jumped a line in his life. It's not the way he's gone about living. But his brother, Jack, their famous Uncle Jack, not only has jumped every line that he's had an opportunity to jump, but believes in it as the American way, right? He says to his brother, you know what this war we just fought was all about, don't you? We know what America is all about. It's the land of backroom deals. And you either subscribe to that notion or you don't. And Ray and his brother Bill have come to, they have to solve these various personal, intimate dilemmas, but they also have to decide what it means to be an American.
Just to keep our listeners straight on the stories, they're all characters in the story Intervention.
Right.
There's another theme that obviously pervades your work, all of your work, and it's certainly present here too, and that's this notion that marriage, that it's hard to sustain a marriage. And again, in Intervention, I think I'm right, isn't it, at the beginning, that Intervention starts off in the garage.
Right.
Where Ray and his wife Paula.
Paula, yes.
They're sitting there, and somehow it comes up, she says, he says to her, would you like me to be somebody different? And she makes a surprising response.
She says, yes. Yeah.
They've been married a while. And and he, at one point, it also says, I'm not quoting you directly, he basically says, well, we've been married so long, do I really have to keep coming up with new stuff?
Yeah, new material.
What marriage is like?
I've been married to the same woman for 45 years.
Do you have to keep coming up with new material?
I think you do, at least occasionally. You know, you can't keep using the same material. It's an abuse. It's an abuse of love to keep telling the same stories in front of your wife, this woman, who is obviously, you can't be married to somebody for 45 years without a certain amount of forbearance. And, you know, you do, for yourself and for her, you have to keep coming up with at least a little bit of new material, because run the risk of getting that answer. Do you wish I was somebody else? Well, yes, I'm tired of you. Of course I'm tired of you.
Let's take another break. When we come back, more with Richard Russo. To Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Richard Russo. His new book is called Trajectory Stories. Okay, I've saved best story for last, and you probably know why. Milton and Marcus. Do you want to give us just a very brief...
I saved it for last as well.
Oh, bad. Give us a very quick summary, just what it's about.
Milton and Marcus is primarily about, I won't say a failed writer. He considers himself to be a failed writer.
A novelist, primarily,
but somebody who has also worked in screenwriting from time to time. And he finds himself in a particularly precarious place as the story opens because his wife is very ill. And he himself, because he is now over the last several years had to survive on kind of visiting writer gigs that don't provide him with health insurance, and because he doesn't work in Hollywood anymore, his Screenwriters Guild insurance has lapsed. He finds himself in a very precarious situation with regard to the next several years coming up. And as he finds himself in the situation, an iconic Hollywood actor director contacts him about 20 pages of a screenplay that he has written over a decade ago and has just kind of disappeared into the void.
Okay, so he's invited to go out and visit with this iconic Hollywood star whose name is Bill Nolan, but everybody calls him Regular Bill because he tries so hard to be an ordinary guy.
Regular guy.
And yeah. He has made a big impact during his career by working with an acting partner, Wendell Pierce, who
right.
your writer has felt very close to. All right. So do you even want us to pretend that this isn't about Robert Redford and Paul Newman?
Well, I certainly don't want you to pretend that it's not about Paul Newman.
Right, because Paul Newman, Wendell Pierce.
Well,
is
I mean, yeah. I did as my protagonist has worked on more than one project with Wendell Pierce, Wendy, as he is known, and has a real personal bond with Wendy. Yeah, and I worked with three different projects with Paul Newman. And what you may not know, actually, reading Milton and Marcus, is that the Milton and Marcus screenplay, which is about half of the story, is something that I wrote over a decade ago for Paul Newman. Because when Paul was becoming ill, and I think he knew and nobody else knew that he was ill, I got a phone call from him one day saying, there's this script that I'm thinking about doing. Would you consider rewriting it? It's not very good. I know it's not very good. And I read it and it wasn't very good. And I also thought there was really nothing for him in it. There just wasn't a very good role in it for him. And he said he was having trouble remembering his lines, and he was thinking really about giving up acting entirely because he didn't want to work with a teleprompter. I mean, he was a very proud man. He didn't want to work with a teleprompter. He wanted to bury himself in the character as he had done with Sully in Nobody's Fool, as he had done with Max Roby in Empire Falls. And he didn't want his lines coming from a machine. He wanted those lines to be deep in his core. He was worried about his failing memory. And I said, well, I can understand that, Paul, but also part of the reason you're having trouble remembering these lines is that they're not memorable. And so I said, I have an idea or two. Let me think about this. And in a matter of about a week, I came up with this idea for this caper movie, Milton and Marcus.
And was that actually the name of the?
That was the name of what I sent him. It's called Milton and Marcus. And I sent it to him, and very quickly after that, I got a response from Paul saying, Richard, these pages sparkle, but I'm awfully afraid I'm going to have to say no. As a matter of fact, it's become clear to me that I can't act anymore. I'm just not going to be able to do this. As you can imagine, my heart was broken.
That's exactly the word.
Not because of Milton and Marcus, but because, you know, we had worked together on three projects. Paul loved writers. I know he had great affection for me. I think like the second or third phone call that I got the day that I won the Pulitzer was from Paul. He said, hot shot. His voice was just there on the line. Hot shot. And so I was heartbroken, and I put Milton and Marcus away. I just didn't deal with it. But then when I had the opportunity to write this novella, suddenly I just yanked the drawer open and found the old pages of Milton and Marcus, and you know, nothing is ever lost. we'll recycle it in some way or other. And so it became the basis of this story about two very different kinds of actors who nevertheless had a fast friendship, who wanted to do one more movie together.
Your story is a love letter to Paul Newman in many ways.
Yeah, it is. It is.
It's also a statement about those stars and what it means when you're in their presence. You saw them. I mean, yeah. Newman for you is an exception because he was a truly, apparently, lovely human being and you had a good friendship. But you also saw enough of L.A. This story is also about what separates the rest of us from the regular bills of the world. It's a remarkable story.
And also how the regular bills, if you're not going to be one of the few like Paul Newman whose humanity always kind of shone through, and even as he became more and more famous, more and more iconic, even as he could have used, you know, all of that, had he wanted to, he still remained the person that he always was. But actually, that business has a way of taking people who want to be that way, who don't want to lose their humanity, who don't want to become privileged dicks. You know, and I don't think that many of the people in this business ever had it in mind, you know, to become privileged or to take that privilege for granted. But the business does it to them.
One of the things about all of your books, and certainly it's true in Trajectory, in the stories in Trajectory, is that you take us into the lives of people who are hapless, who, as we read about them, there are times we find ourselves terribly frustrated that they just don't figure it out and get yeah. on with it.
Yeah.
Some of them are dealing in deep economic crisis. And so in some ways, there are times when we read some of your characters, we're uncomfortable because we don't want the failure. We don't want to see them fail. One of the things that's remarkable, and it's certainly true in this book, is that your characters find a moment to change, to grow, mm-hmm. to overcome. Mm-hmm. Every character in this book has a moment mm-hmm. where something flips, and instead of being mired in despair, they find a way to move on. And it says to me that you must be one of the most optimistic and hopeful people writing today, because that's a trademark of yours.
Some of it probably has to do with the fact that I just fall in love with these people, and there's only so much pain and torment I can give them, and feel good about myself. Which is not to say that my characters' lives turn completely around at the end of these stories. That's certainly not the case.
Yeah, you're not a Pollyanna.
No,
the changes
by no
are
means.
Often very subtle.
Yes, very. They're very subtle, but they are optimistic. And it's interesting that, you know, my friend Robert Benton and I have had this conversation.
The great director
Robert Benton and I have had this conversation many times, in which he is. He says exactly what you've said, that I am optimistic. And he also, because Benton is a much more religious man than I am, he connects that in some way to a kind of latent Catholicism that I have always thought that I expelled, but which he claims I haven't. And as we talk about this, it all comes down, interestingly, to, in Empire Falls, the glove box in Empire Falls, because at the end of the story, Miles has taken his daughter Tick to away from Empire Falls after the tragic events, the shooting at the end of that novel. He has taken his beloved daughter Tick to Martha's Vineyard, where they have kind of hid out while she can heal after what's happened to her. And Max, Miles's father, her grandfather, finally tracks them down there, and they all decide it's time to go home. And they're in the line for the ferry. And there's been this running gag throughout the novel about the glove box in Miles's car, which keeps flopping down. He keeps trying to he slams it shut, and every time it looks like it's going to remain shut, then he'll hit a bump in the road, and down comes the glove box door. And they're getting on the boat. They're getting on the ferry. He goes up over the ramp, and down comes the glove box door. And Max says to his son, "You haven't fixed that yet." And Miles says, "I don't think it can be." And Max says, "Don't be an idiot. Anything can be fixed."
That is...
Yes. It's all it is, as all it is a glove box. But such is the hope for all of us, isn't it? That there are things in our lives that we can fix. Along with all those things that we can't, there are those grace moments. And I've never admitted this to Benton, but I think he's right in this. He's right in the sense that there are, I know, latent elements of faith and probably Catholicism in my work. And I think of them, I mean, the language itself is suggestive, isn't it? These are grace moments.
Richard Russo, you've given me and hundreds of thousands of readers of your books, including this book, Trajectory, many of those moments. I have to tell you that I know you are out on tour. I know you'll do 14,000 interviews over the time of the tour. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate your generosity in talking today with such energy and such thoughtfulness. To me, just one of the many guys who you're going to see. So thank you so much for being here.
It's been such a pleasure and such an honor. Thank you so much for your interest in my work.
Before we said goodbye to Richard Russo, we asked him to share with us a selection from Trajectory. He chose a passage from the story called Horseman. Here's the setup. Janet Moore has had a disappointing career as a professor of literature. Her marriage is passionless. She has a special needs child she seems to shun. Now middle-aged, Janet believes she can see the start of her disappointing life taking shape in a single encounter with the brilliant and renowned literary critic who's her teacher.
"Look, Janet," he said, perhaps intuiting her distress. "The truth is, I can teach you very little. You have a lively intellect and genuine curiosity, and you work hard. You read carefully, synthesize well, and know how to marshal evidence. If a scholar's life is what you want, you're well on your way. That's the good news. But there is one last piece of the puzzle. Unfortunately, it's a big one. And for some people, it can be elusive." A big, existential something she hadn't even noticed? She didn't want to believe that. Her other professors all agreed that she was probably ready to start submitting her work to academic periodicals. Bellamy knew the editors of these journals personally, and a word from him. And if what she had overlooked was so big, how could it be elusive? That didn't make sense at all. Then again, what if what he was saying was true? Hadn't she sometimes worried, in the aftermath of extravagant praise, that something was missing? Or had the distinct impression that what she'd really succeeded in doing was fooling her professors yet again? Is that what Bellamy was getting at? Had he seen something in her work, or just noted the absence of something? He was arguing for a kind of passionate, personal connection. She understood this much. But what if that connection wasn't there? What if she possessed, and what her other professors admired, was merely a facility? If she was just doing what she was good at, and it didn't go any deeper than that? This elusive thing, she heard herself saying, in a frightened, childlike voice, "I won't succeed until I find it." "Oh, you'll succeed just fine," he told her, waving that concern away. "You'll just never be any good."
That's Richard Russo reading from his new book, Trajectory. As always, you'll find information about the book and Russo's career on our website at gpb.org/TWS. And you can find us on Facebook, too. We're about out of time for this week's show. Remember, if you can't listen to us when we're on the radio, you can subscribe to the Two-Way Street podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And all of our shows are archived on our website. Our senior producer is Jenny Amond. Jenny edited today's show. Our producer is Lisa Clark. Our associate producer is Olivia Rheingold. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. And our interns are Chastity Wingard and Peyton Hawkins. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening. I hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.